They have their entrances and their exits, as Shakespeare so memorably described the stages of public life. And this past month has seen a big formal exit, the retirement of one of Australia's most prominent public servants, but also his entrance to another stage of his life as Chancellor of the University of Queensland. Peter Varghese left his post as head of our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade at the end of June, 2 years ahead of time, I might add, to return to his native Brisbane and to his large extended family and new university position. Strictly speaking, is not his first home. That was actually Kenya, where he was born to parents who hailed from Kerala in southern India, and he arrived here at the age of five, which makes his subsequent rise through school, university, where he won the university medal, leading on to a distinguished diplomatic career, all the more creditable, a true example of our capacity to provide altogether new possibilities for migrants. He couldn't speak to us while he was a serving secretary due to public service rules, but he's free to now about the various challenges facing Australia trying to navigate a volatile world. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Morning, Geraldine. Delighted to be here.
Welcome after 38 years as a public servant. I wonder how it feels to be out of work, as it were, facing up to new routines.
Well, Geraldine, whatever withdrawal symptoms I may be suffering from are compensated by glorious Brisbane winters and working with a terrific institution in the University of Queensland. So I think I'm still coping.
Why did you leave early, by the way?
Well, I had always wanted to have a career after government. And I think you do need to make a decision about how much time you give yourself to do that. And I had recently turned 60. I was offered the opportunity to take up the chancellorship of the university, which I'm delighted to do. And I want to build up a portfolio of things across the university corporate sectors and also do some writing and speaking.
I just wondered if you didn't want to have to offer advice in the future about people like Kevin Rudd or becoming head of the United Nations. Do you care to comment?
No, I think I'll pass on that.
Oh, just funny about that. Now, of course, you are retiring at a time of incredible turbulence internationally. And after eight, we're going to talk to the historian Margaret McMillan about precisely this. But, you know, when various established orders seem to be threatened, you have to offer frank and fearless advice. You're known for doing precisely that at a time when, say, Turkey is unravelling before our very eyes. Extraordinary developments. We've just got this morning stories about hackers hacking into aviation systems in Vietnam, broadcasting to the whole assembled groups in the airports unscheduled messages about the South China Sea. And you've got the blow up, for instance, in Malaysia of the 1MDB scandal, really gathering pace with the United States now, freezing money and clearly implying, without naming him, the Prime Minister Najib. How do you offer calm, dispassionate, frank and fearless advice at a time like now?
Well, Geraldine, there's always going to be a lot of churn in international relations. That just comes with the territory. I think the thing for Australia is to focus on its interests, its hard interests and its soft interests, and to try and place itself in a position where it can be as nimble and as adaptable as it can, because we can't predict the future. We can't say with certainty what's going to happen. So our response capability is really what our future success is going to turn on. And while I think churn is always there, I do believe that we are nearing an inflection point globally. And it's important that we get this right, because a number of things are happening below the waterline. Our geopolitics is shifting as a result of the rearrangement of economic weight, especially in our region. We're coming off a long period of economic growth and prosperity in Australia's case, the longest single period of uninterrupted growth. Technology is doing what it's always done, redefining the way we work and the jobs we have. And I think importantly, the comfort level in many countries about globalization is shifting. There is now more questioning about what the balance sheet of globalization is. And if you take all of these factors together, it is, in my view, approaching an inflection point globally. And we need to prepare ourselves for it.
How do we prepare ourselves? In other words, what do you think is our greatest immediate challenge?
Well, we have to hang on to what we do well, and we have to adapt to what we need to do better. Now, you know, the Australian story has been a remarkable achievement when you think about it. I mean, we are a strong liberal democracy. We are a country which is a genuine success story multiculturally. We have an egalitarian ethos. We have a laconic character. And we have been a wealthy nation. So I think the challenge for us is to hang on to our national character while repositioning ourselves economically. So much of this is going to turn on our ability to create a more productive and a more adaptable economy that fits our strengths. And we're a lucky country in that sense.
That seems, now a lot of people might say, gee, that's not what I necessarily expected the head of foreign affairs to say, you know, to start reflecting domestically. And you've acknowledged in a very interesting speech that you gave just about a month before you retired, that we are not doing anything like the depth of analysis that we need to be doing. And it's critical that we get back to it.
Well, I spoke about the tyranny of the current, and the point I was trying to make there is not that we can ignore the current. I mean, the current is always going to be our major preoccupation. But, you know, as a great English philosopher once said, government is really a pact between the past, the present, and the future. And we need to find more time to focus on the future element of that pact. And that means, as Bill English had just been saying to you, thinking about what's coming down the track over the next 5, 10 and 15 years. Because if we don't do that, then I think our capacity to take advantage of these opportunities that are ahead, there are many challenges ahead, but there are also many opportunities ahead. If we don't do that in a deeper sense, then I think we'll be the poorer for it, literally.
Is there time to do that in the modern public service?
We need to create the time to do it, not just in the public service, but also, I think, across our politics. I have every confidence that we can do it if we put a sustained effort into it. But we also need to recognise that the rhythms of our life, much of this driven by technology, is making it harder for us to carve out time for deeper reflection. And ultimately, without deeper reflection, you cannot plan for the future.
I noticed that in the latest quarterly essay, the correspondence to Laura Tingle's earlier essay about corporate memory in government was very interesting, including one from Amanda Walsh, a woman called Amanda Walsh, who used to work for DFAT. And I just want to read to you, it was pointed out to me last night, she was saying that she didn't think there was anything like the depth of scholarly work that she imagined there would be in an elite organisation, as you know, it's known as one of the elite agencies of the public service, DFAT. But this is what she wrote: with the notable exception of the highly technical work of our negotiators in the World Trade Organization's Doha round, DFAT simply didn't, quotes, do policy in the late 1990s and the early years of the new millennium. And she actually said, I can list off a reel off a list of former colleagues, all stunningly bright and personable, who left DFAT around the time I did. Without exception, they beat a path to policy-based work in academia, think tank, or politics.
Well, I think that's a relatively harsh assessment, Geraldine. I do accept the point that we need to be doing more of it. I think we have been doing quite a bit of it. But, you know, we need to consciously improve and deepen our policy work. And one of the things I did want to make, one of the points I wanted to make in my speech was that unless we can drag ourselves away from this tyranny of the present, we will pay a cost. So I don't accept the view that the department has been doing nothing. I think it has done a lot of very good policy work. And if you look at the repositioning of Australia in the Indo-Pacific region, if you look at the work that's been done on the crafting of regional institutions, and if you look at the way in which our bigger bilateral relationships have been shepherded, I think all of that actually does reflect a fairly serious amount of policy thinking.
And the integration of the Australian Agency for International Development, I think people generally know it as AusAid, being brought in, which was, of course, a government decision under the Abbott government, that's widely believed to have been going, it not been going terribly easily and terribly well. I just wondered if that played a role in your departure.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I was a supporter of the integration. I think aligning our aid policy better with our foreign and trade policy, I think focusing the aid policy on economic growth, these are all good objectives. And I think it was to the credit of the then government that they pursued integration. It was an unbelievably complicated organisational merger. I mean, to bring together two global operations and to blend two cultures is not easy. But while we didn't get it perfectly right, we got it much more right than I thought we would. So I, in the end, was more than satisfied with the way in which the integration had been handled.
I regret I have a minute, so I'm going to ask you, your greatest pride in what diplomacy has been able to achieve, in your view?
Well, I think the way in which Australia recognised early the great opportunities in Asia and positioned itself to be a close partner and a provider of goods and services to the Asian market will be seen in retrospect as a very profound, correct foreign policy call by Australia. Going back to the Garnaut report on Australia and the Northeast Asian ascendancy.
Okay. Now I'm going to stop you right there. I'm sorry to do this to you. I do hope we speak again and enjoy the next stage of life.
Thanks very much, Geraldine.
Peter Varghese, who is the outgoing head of Foreign Affairs and Trade, of course, Frances Adamson, the first woman to take the role, has succeeded him.